You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
The Pet Doctor is sponsored by Ellie Mae Pet Supplements. Visit us at battle-cancer.com for more information on how Ellie Mae Supplements can help your dog.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
It almost seems to be a weekly occurrence, the recall of pet food or treats because of bacterial contamination. Of course, we don't want our pets to be sickened by tainted food. But did you know that you or a member of your two-legged family could also become ill from these products? And then there are the stories of children being sickened by their pet turtles, along with headlines of people and pets sharing viral and bacterial infections such as H1N1 or MRSA. You love your pet. But is it worth the risk of contracting one of these diseases? How do you ensure that you provide a healthy environment for your pets and yourself? Dr. Sharon Hunt Girardo, a veterinarian, doctor of microbiology and immunology, and a pet lover, will answer some frequently asked questions about worms, germs, and life with our pets. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly. Right after these messages.
Did you know cancer is the number one cause of death in dogs? One out of every three dogs is affected by cancer at some point during his lifetime. And half of those dogs affected die. Shocking, isn't it? Symptoms of dog cancer are nonspecific and often lead to a late diagnosis of the disease. But before it reaches an advanced or incurable stage, cancer exhibits mild but recurring symptoms. If you think your dog is losing weight, has a loss of appetite, looking dull and listless, is non-social, or has any sores, swellings, bumps or lumps, or abnormal growth anywhere, it's time to visit the vet to make sure everything's well. This message is brought to you by Ellie Mae Pet Supplements. Ellie Mae is an animal healthcare company that creates products which focus on improving the overall health and quality of life for your much-loved pet. Visit us at www.battle-cancer.com for more information on dog cancer and how Ellie Mae supplements can help your dog.
Buster, you're telling me my dog food products can't go on your shelves?
That's right. Didn't pass one of my Petco certified nutrition checklists. Sorry, Wayne.
Who made these checklists?
Geniuses. Very smart guys.
Well, it's good enough for most grocery stores.
Do you see cheese puffs on my shelves? Mayonnaise? Soda pop?
No.
That's because I ain't running no grocery store, Wayne. Your pets will get better nutrition, I guarantee it. Petco, where the healthy pets go.
Enter the code DR10, DOCTOR, the number 10, and get 10% off any order. No minimum at Petco.com.
Hi everybody, I'm Megan Blake here with my sidekick, Super Smiley, the giant mutt and spokes dog for throwaways. You're listening to Pet Life Radio, and I'd like to tell you about our brand new show, A Super Smiley Adventure. Our show explores adventures with animals. They can be traveling, out in the world trips, or inner journeys where our animals lead us to inspiration and self-discovery, or just plain fun adventures. Join us here on Pet Life Radio on A Super Smiley Adventure. Good boy.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Sharon, thank you so much for being with us. I know this is a real concern with so many people, and there's a lot of mythology and just erroneous information out there.
Yes, there is. There's a lot of misinformation and a lot of things that can scare people out there, people that are probably not at real high risk.
So speaking of people who would be at high risk, who in a family is someone that we need to take extra precautions with. Watch very closely.
Okay, it's going to depend on what type of a bacterial pathogen or organism that we're concerned about. But in general, the very young in the household, and we're talking infants and children even up to the age of 5-year-old, we're talking about the elderly. We'd be talking about anybody that is immunosuppressed, perhaps on cancer treatment drugs, or who have some sort of disease that would suppress their immune system. And even in some cases, people that are home recovering from surgery or recovering from some other debilitating type of illness. These would be the groups of people that you'd be most concerned about contracting one of these diseases that we can pass back and forth between ourselves and our pets.
So should we not have pets when we have people like this in the household?
No, I don't think that's the answer. I think that there are things that we can do to minimize the risk for these types of people. One of the things might be being very wise about your selection of pets. And as you've already mentioned, having those small turtles when you've got young children in the household. In fact, any type of reptile is not a good idea when you've got young children because most of them have a high carriage rate or a high potential to be contaminated with salmonella. And our young children are particularly at risk of contracting this disease. So reptiles for young children would be a poor choice. Ducklings, young chicks, these also have a high potential for carrying salmonella, and you're going to want to be careful with your young children. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have dogs, cats, or other pets while they're young, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't own reptiles at all. It's a matter of being careful with the ones who are most at risk of potentially contracting these infections.
I think it's somewhat amazing that, you know, baby boomers ever made it to the age that we are right now because, yes, as children, I remember having these little red ear sliders and playing with it and having lots of fun and probably didn't wash my hands as often as I was supposed to. And, yes, in the old days, I used to get chicks and ducklings for Easter and play with them and drank water out of hoses outside that probably were not lead-free and didn't have seatbelts, but hey, a lot of us still made it. So, Dr. Sharon, why is it a problem with these little turtles? They don't say, well, you shouldn't have big ones. They always keep talking about these little red ear sliders or other types of reptiles and amphibians.
It seems like for some reason, the small ones, and maybe it has something to do with the age. I am not particularly certain on this, but it just seems like they are able to isolate that salmonella bacteria more frequently from these little small red sliders than they are from the larger turtles. And it might also be that we don't see a lot of the large ones. Sadly, people aren't always aware of the best means of raising these small critters, and a lot of them don't make it to a larger size. I don't know if that's part of it, but I don't personally have not seen a lot of owners of larger turtles. And it seems like these little ones seem very attractive for small children in the parents' eyes.
They seem to be so easy to take care of. Here's the little container, add some water, they have the fake palm tree, put in a little bit of food, poof, you're done it, and you're right. I think most of them
exactly.
Don't survive.
You can pick them up at the flea market, and it's kind of all self-contained. You know, for a few dollars, you've got the pet, you've got the home, and you bring it home. And people often pick these things up without any forethought of how they're going to take care of it in the proper manner.
So we've been talking right now about salmonella. Salmonella can affect pets, but typically it seems like the dog or the cat has that lead stomach that can just handle, you know, these pathogens, these bugs that go right on through and don't seem to cause too many problems. What would be the signs of a person, for instance, having salmonella?
With salmonella, you're going to have some very uncomfortable diarrhea. And it can progress to more life-threatening type of disease where it seems like as if it's unstoppable. There might be some blood in the diarrhea. And again, we're concerned about the small children. It's more easy for them to become dehydrated than an older person. The elderly, on the other side, also more easy for them to become dehydrated. So one of the primary signs that you're going to see in people is some really bad diarrhea. Not a pleasant disease to have.
Thank you very much. No, don't want it. And as I was mentioning in the introduction, now we're hearing about these recalls all the time about pig ears or other foods, raw foods that people love to feed to their pets being recalled because of salmonella. So how are the people getting exposed to this? I feed it into my pet. How is that affecting me?
Well, the exposure to people is going to be the hands-on contact. You're touching these items that are potentially contaminated with the salmonella, and it's a hand-to-mouth contamination. You know, you touch the product, you're picking up the bug, it's on your hands, and if you're not washing properly after handling these items, there's a big potential for these organisms to then end up in your mouth, from your mouth to your GI tract, and voila, now you are sick. So one of the ways that we can help avoid contaminating ourselves is to remember to wash our hands thoroughly after handling any dog, cat food, treat, any type of item that could potentially be contaminated with salmonella. And another one that I know has been in the news, not so much in the pet food, but the same sort of argument goes for that as well, is the E. coli. Wash your hands. These organisms, you know, do not penetrate your skin per se. They're coming in via your mucous membranes and your mouth in particular. So if you've washed your hands, you're careful not to contaminate other items in the environment that you may then touch later, not knowing that they've been contaminated. These are the ways that you're going to get yourself, your family sick. So wash your hands after handling these items.
I know, Dr. Sharon Hunt-Gerardo, you were just at a veterinary meeting for veterinarians in my area of Southern California. Okay, washing your hands. We all know how to wash our hands. Come on, give me a break. You get, you know, some soap and water. I know sometimes children and adults, you go in, yeah, you wash it with some water. And I think a lot of it's peer pressure too. You go into a public restroom, you're going, okay, somebody's watching, so I better use soap and water now, because otherwise, maybe at home you just let it slide. But you are showing that there is a real distinct way that you are supposed to wash your hands. So I know this is radio, but how are we supposed to wash our hands and how long?
Okay, well, for how long, it should be a minimum of 20 seconds. And this is one of the areas where, in general, we people have poor performance. We've got a poor conception of how long 20 seconds is. So most of us know the happy birthday song. If you sing the happy birthday song through, and you sing it through at a regular pace, not rushing through it, you should get a good 20 seconds out of that. As far as the technique goes, the best thing to do, and I know this is hard for people, and I admit I don't always do it myself, is if you know you've been in a situation where you are potentially contaminated, if your hands are visibly dirty, you can see dirt or grime or whatever on your hands, the first thing you want to do is remove your jewelry if you're wearing anything. And then thoroughly wet your hands. Leave that water running because you don't want to touch that faucet again, you know, during the time you're washing your hands. Get a good amount of soap on your hands. Rub it, lather it in to cover the whole hand. And get your wrists as well. And then you want to make sure you're covering all the surface of your hands. So the technique would involve then sliding your left hand over your right hand and in between your fingers, and then reversing that. And then you want to do what we call the finger hook lock. So you're going to interlock your fingers and scrub away there. Then get each one of your thumbs separately, because this is an area that often gets ignored or gone past when you're washing your hands, doesn't get a real thorough coverage. So get each one of those thumbs individually. And then take your fingertips and kind of rotate them around in the palm of your hand. And this is going to help you get under those fingernails and get the palms of your hands real well. If that hasn't taken 20 seconds, start all over and keep rubbing and lathering. And then rinse real thoroughly. And when you're turning off the water, don't use your nice clean hand to turn that water off. Either use your forearm, grab for a towel, use the towel to cover that faucet and turn it off that way. And make sure your hands are dried thoroughly before you move on to the next item in your day. And the whole reason for this is to literally wash away the germs. And it's not really going to matter in an everyday situation if you're using a plain soap or an antimicrobial type of soap. It's more the action of washing and physically removing the organism. That's what's going to be the best help. And so it's very important to get the whole surface of your hands so that you don't leave any little nasty bugs lurking anywhere on your hands.
Does it make a difference when we're in a public restroom situation to use paper towels or to use some of these blowers? Is one better than the other?
I don't believe one is better than the other. I think what's going to happen is going to come down to how well the facility is maintaining their premises there. And if you can turn on that blow dryer without touching your clean hand to it, because you don't know who's been there before and what's been done. So if you can turn on that blow dryer without contaminating your hands, I think that's a good method. And the paper towels are great, too, if you can get to them without having to touch a whole lot of other items. I always like to keep that paper towel in my hand, and I use it to open the door because I know I've seen, and I know you have too, people come in and use a public restroom and they walk out without washing their hands. I don't want to now take my clean hand and touch that door handle if I can avoid it.
One of the best public restrooms I've ever seen, it was at a convention center. It was in actually Long Beach, California. They had, you know, a nice clean restroom, and then it's like, oh, how am I supposed to open this door? Okay, fine, paper towel or not. And some restrooms are now actually putting a waste disposal bin right outside the door, which, duh, makes sense. But they also had some of the alcohol-based hand cleaners, so you could open the door in case you didn't have your paper towel, and there you go, and you have your hand sanitizer. And since I'm on that subject, do hand sanitizers really work? There's all these different scents and cute things, etc., but are they effective?
Well, the hand sanitizers can be effective, and what is recommended is the use of an alcohol-based hand rub. And you're going to want at least 65 to 90% alcohol in that hand rub for it to be effective. Now, the other types of disinfectants in the hand rubs, they may work, but the problem is those products can become contaminated with organisms that are resistant to whatever that chemical is that's being used as a disinfectant. So what you end up doing is recontaminating your hands. So we don't recommend using the other types of products. You want to use something with an alcohol base to it. And a lot of them will have emollients or other types of products in it to help keep your hands moist. So yes, these are really good products to use. They're very effective for a lot of types of organisms that can cause infection. What their limitation is that if your hands are visibly dirty, the alcohol really can't penetrate dirt and grime to get down to disinfecting and killing those microorganisms that can cause disease. So if your hands are visibly dirty, you still need to think about using soap and water to clean. And if that's not available, some of these moist hand wipes, you'll get that physical, mechanical action wiping away the organisms. And then you can follow up with the alcohol-based hand rub if you want a good disinfecting. In fact, in the human healthcare industry, the alcohol-based hand rub is now the standard of care. So I'm assuming if it's good enough for our nurses and our doctors, it should be good enough for us, with the caveat to wash if your hands are visibly dirty.
Well, Mom was right. Wash your hands after you finish playing with that dog, cat, turtle, or snake. Right now I'm chatting with Dr. Sharon Hunt Girardo. She is a veterinarian. Also, she likes school, so she's a PhD in microbiology and immunology. We'll be right back after this short break talking about how to keep you and your pets healthy and happy. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Love your pets but wish their medications were a lot less expensive? They are at 1-800-PetMeds. You'll not only save on flea and heartworm medications, but on prescriptions for arthritis, incontinence, thyroid, and more. And you get fast service, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Plus, our licensed pharmacists ensure accuracy, monitor drug interaction, and more. See why over 5 million people have trusted their pet's health to 1-800-PetMeds, America's largest pet pharmacy. Call now or order online.
Go to PetMeds.com/doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, to get 10% off any order and free shipping on orders of $39 or more at PetMeds.com.
Did you know cancer is the number one cause of death in dogs? One out of every three dogs is affected by cancer at some point during his lifetime. And half of those dogs affected die. Shocking, isn't it? Symptoms of dog cancer are nonspecific and often lead to a late diagnosis of the disease. But before it reaches an advanced or incurable stage, cancer exhibits mild but recurring symptoms. If you think your dog is losing weight, has a loss of appetite, looking dull and listless, is non-social, or has any sores, swellings, bumps, or lumps, or abnormal growth anywhere, it's time to visit the vet to make sure everything's well. This message is brought to you by Ellie Mae Pet Supplements. Ellie Mae is an animal healthcare company that creates products which focus on improving the overall health and quality of life for your much-loved pet. Visit us at www.battle-cancer.com for more information on dog cancer and how Ellie Mae Supplements can help your dog.
Hi, this is Marcy Davis and my service dog, Whistle, and we're your hosts of Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Working Like Dogs is the show where you can learn everything you ever wanted to know about working animals or working dogs. Whether you're a member of a working dog team, or you've just seen a working dog or animal out at the mall or the grocery store, and you're curious about how these amazing animals work with their human partners, then Working Like Dogs is the show for you. Join us for the inside scoop at Working Like Dogs on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets
on Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Sharon, a concern that so many people have is now something called MRSA. People giving it to pets or coming from pets to people. What is MRSA?
MRSA is a resistant form of the Staphylococcus organism. And unfortunately, this resistance is kind of a multi-resistant organism. There are many antibiotics that this bug is no longer susceptible to. So that if you become infected with the organism, there are limited choices for antibiotics that can be used to help you fight that infection.
Now, staph is normally on our skin and on our pet skin. So where did this superbug come from?
Well, we're not really sure exactly where it came from, but the thought is that it has come from the overuse of antibiotics or the improper use of antibiotics. So that once in the past, it was probably your usual Staphylococcus aureus organism. But with the use of antibiotics, these bugs are very smart. They find ways to get around it because their goal is to survive. And they have picked up different genetic material that now helps them resist a variety of organisms. So one of the theories is that it may have originated in a human hospital situation where a lot of antibiotics get used because we've got a lot of very sick patients. Another theory is that it could have originated among our animals where in production antibiotics are often used as part of the day-to-day routine.
So with this MRSA, it seems like it is something that humans have given to animals and not the other way around. Is that correct?
The evidence looks like in many cases that is exactly what's happening. It's not a usual organism for our dogs and our cats. They've got their own staphylococcal organisms that are different than the strain in humans. But there have been some cases in production animals where it looks like it might be coming from the animals to humans. But in your usual pet situation, it does seem like MRSA or MRSA is something that's more going from the human back to the animal.
And then last winter, when we had all this hoopla about H1N1, a lot of people remember that as being swine flu, a bad term that was changed. They're finding that cats were coming down with this, dogs. I think there were some ferrets and other little creatures, you know. And again, was this something that people were giving to animals? Were the animals the source of the problem?
In the case of the influenza, I believe that it was the animals that were the source of it. Not your pets, per se, but again, the production animals. And the flu virus is a very interesting organism that it is highly adaptable. It is constantly changing, which is why we're encouraged to get our flu shots every year, because we are being vaccinated then with new strains as we are trying to predict which one is going to be the next big bug in humans. But the influenza virus generally comes from production animals. In this case, you know, pigs were one of the sources. In many of the situations, birds are going to be the sources. So pigs and birds are kind of the, if you will, the mixing vials for these organisms. And then every once in a while, we'll get one of these super strains that come out of it and can cause serious disease in humans. And in this case, this one happened to be able to also infect our dogs and our cats.
It is amazing how everything is so interrelated. We're talking about dogs and cats and swine, etc. But I was just reading in the American Veterinary Medical Association's journal about plague being in Colorado, and plague is something that people get coming from fleas. And then also on the northwest portion of the United States, some of our seals and sea otters and dolphins actually coming down with toxoplasmosis. What are your views about how people and pets are affecting our wildlife?
Well, I don't have a real strong opinion about that. What I will say is that, interestingly, the majority of the diseases out there are zoonotic diseases, and I'm talking a good 60 to 70%. So this means that these diseases are fully capable of going back and forth between the human and the animal population. And without the appropriate, more molecular type of studies where we're getting down to the DNA level, we may never know, did it come from humans? Did it come from animals? Unless we can pinpoint the very first time an infection like that, you know, appears. Now, the plague seems to be something that gets harbored in the wildlife population. It can affect humans, but I believe it's more of a secondary type of infection for humans. But it tends to reside in the rodents and then is passed around among them via the fleas. And in that case, the rodents don't get sick. They kind of just harbor this organism. And then when you get a secondary host, such as a human, we're the ones that are going to get sick with this particular type of organism. So in this case, you know, my concern is handling wildlife and having your pets exposed to wildlife, that you want to be careful that your animals have gotten the proper flea and tick prevention to help keep them from picking up those fleas that might have been infected, and then helping them avoid, you know, mouthing wildlife that they might find out there that could potentially be infected.
It happens so quickly, too. You don't think about it. I live in Southern California. We just even have bunnies going through the backyard. They can bring things in. You were talking about birds. You know, there's fleas on birds that can cause problems. And yes, we need to be just so totally cautious about what our animals come in contact with, even drinking some of the puddle water. Here in Southern California, we use a lot of reclaimed water, and we know that it's a source of certain types of organisms that can cause problems for our pets.
Yes, yes. And you know, I don't want to frighten your listeners here. Yes, these bugs are out there, but if we are cautious, and we adopt the appropriate measures, we keep our pets vaccinated. If we have an indoor cat, we make sure that cat stays indoor. If we do have a cat that goes outside, make sure that cat is properly vaccinated. Our dogs, the same thing. Make sure they've got their vaccines. Make sure they're getting their regular flea and tick prevention. You know, because they are, whether we see it or not, they are potentially exposed to wildlife out there, even in the city. Even in the cities, there's going to be wildlife out there that could potentially cause harm to your pets and then secondarily, possibly to you.
To back up a little bit, when you were chatting about MRSA and antibiotics, and okay, there are times I know I'm given a 10-day course of antibiotics, and after about day four, starting to feel pretty good. It's going, I don't need to finish these. It's kind of a pain to remember to take something twice a day and the rest of it. And I know that compliance with my own pet owners and their pets, sometimes the cat doesn't like taking the medication. The dog is a pill about taking pills. So people don't really want to continue on with it. Antibiotics seem to be a real hot button item right now, about especially antibiotics in our foodstuffs, you know, in veterinary agriculture, animal husbandry. Would you care to talk about antibiotics in those creatures and how we should properly take antibiotics?
Well, the main thing is to take the full course of the antibiotic that you're given. This kind of counterintuitively does help avoid having any organisms then come up that are resistant to that particular antibiotic. It's like you're going to wipe them all out and not leave anybody behind if you get them with the first hit. We are constantly reevaluating how long the course of antibiotics should be for any particular illness. But whether it's your doctor or your veterinarian recommending a course of antibiotics, it should be taken for the full course, because this helps prevent a reservoir of bacteria in yourself or in your pets that could potentially then become resistant to that particular antibiotic.
Because there's different types of bacteria. I usually tell clients, because there's easy to kill bugs and then there are cousins that are harder to kill. So if you just kill off the easy to kill ones, those bad bugs are just sitting there going, ha ha, you missed me, and I am back with a vengeance.
Yeah, and they bring their friends and their family members, and you've got quite a crew of the bad guys there. So yeah, it's very important to finish that course. And I know it's frustrating, particularly with pets. I have a cat of my own here that is very difficult to get antibiotics down, and we struggle with her on the rare occasions that she has to take that. But it's very important to remember to do that. And also remember that your veterinarian is your ally. If you're having troubles, talk to your veterinarian. Talk to the staff. Maybe they've got some ideas on how better to do this, or to give you an alternate way to do it. You know, don't sit silently in frustration. You know, reach out for help if your animal is a problem for giving antibiotics to, because there are different options that you might not be aware of, but that your veterinarian or the veterinary staff can offer you as an alternative to help you get these medications into your pet in an appropriate manner.
I love it, because now there is an injectable antibiotic. It's not for all sorts of infections, but will last up to 14 days. So it's a little bit more pricey than having to get the pill, but when the pill or the liquid's not going down, it's like, thankfully, this is a situation where I can use this injection. Do you feel comfortable talking about antibiotics in animal husbandry?
I'm not real knowledgeable about it. I have some thoughts and some opinions, but it's not an area that I'm by any means an expert in.
I think it's one of these areas where people, when they are concerned, instead of just, I think, that immediate knee-jerk reaction that antibiotics are necessarily incorrect, when used properly, they can, I think, be of assistance, allow our animals to grow more healthy. It is very difficult in a herd situation, if it's chickens or pigs or cattle or whatever, to make sure that they're all healthy. It's not like a one-on-one situation with our own pets at home. Would you agree with that?
Very much so. And I think that the average American citizen has been so far removed from the animal husbandry, the farming, that we don't fully understand that medicine in these herd or flock situation is not the same as it is in our small animal medicine or in our human medicine. I mean, you are absolutely right. We don't necessarily treat individuals. In a case like this, if you've got one cow or one bird that comes down with an infectious disease, you're pretty well guaranteed that if something isn't done right now, not just to treat that animal, but to treat all the animals that have had exposure to the infected one, that whole herd will very likely come down with that particular disease. And I think one example that the public might be able to understand, because it's been in the news so much, was the foot and mouth disease, for which we don't have a treatment. But it's an example of a highly contagious disease that we have seen that one of the responses in Great Britain, when they had, you find one infected animal, they end up putting down the whole herd. And this is kind of the same concept that we'd want to be doing with our antibiotics. If you've got a treatment, you're going to want to not only treat the one that's sick, you're going to want to treat everybody to prevent that disease from spreading throughout the herd and having very devastating effects. And I think the other thing that I'd like the public to understand is that these antibiotics, you know, legally need to come through a veterinarian, so that there usually is a veterinarian there advising on how to distribute the antibiotic and what type of antibiotic to use, so that it's not a free-for-all out there, that there is some control over this. And some of the things that we're hearing in the media now are kind of, to me, scare tactics and really not fair to the animal industry and not fair in the sense of good animal welfare to pull antibiotics totally from the food animal production. I think it could have devastating effects on our food animal industry and the welfare of those animals in those flocks and herds.
And our economy, since it all is totally intertwined. Dr. Sharon Hunt-Girardeau, thank you so much for being with us. I know that you have really put to rest some of the questions that people have about antibiotics, living safely with our pets. If you have someone who is very young, old, immunosuppressed, do you have to get rid of those pets? And it sounds so, nope, but follow what Mom always said. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands. Keep it clean and don't allow the passage of these organisms inadvertently because you failed to take the proper precautions.
Well, you're listening to The Pet Doctor. I'm Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in again next week. We'll have more information so you can be the best possible pet owner you can be. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
The Pet Doctor is sponsored by Ellie Mae Pet Supplements. Ellie Mae is an animal healthcare company that creates products which focus on improving the overall health and quality of life for your much-loved pet. Visit us at www.battle-cancer.com for more information on dog cancer and how Ellie Mae supplements can help your dog.